Sears has been part of American Life for 125 years, but as of this morning, the retailer has filed for bankruptcy.
Sears offered Americans the opportunity to realize the dream of the middle class in an affordable way. Unfortunately, I don't see a way forward for Sears.
That's management professor James O'Rourke. He joins us to unpack the latest news. And if you have memories of shopping or working at Sears, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Plus, Illinois has been home to some of our country's greatest scientists. We'll hear about some of them, including James Watson, who discovered DNA. Here he is giving a TED Talk.
You know, it all happened in about 2 hours. If you just put A next to T and G next to C, you have a copying mechanism.
But first, you've probably heard of the so-called blue wave for November's midterm elections. That path runs through a handful of close races. This morning, we'll take a look at two of them on opposite ends of the state. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, one of Illinois' most iconic brands, Sears, filed for bankruptcy this morning. What does it mean for the company, its current workers, and retirees? Later, we also continue the state's bicentennial celebration by looking at some of Illinois' best-known scientists, from Enrico Fermi to James Watson. But first, you've probably heard by now about the so-called blue wave. How big does it need to be? 24 is actually the minimum number of seats the Democratic Party needs in order to gain control of the House of Representatives on Election Day. There's an election for all 435 House seats every 2 years, but the vast majority of them aren't competitive. Usually, control over the House comes down to a handful of tightly contested races. And we're going to be talking about two of those now. Regular listeners of the 21st have been hearing about Illinois' 13th District. That's where Congressman Rodney Davis is hoping to hold on to his seat against Democratic Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. We heard from Congressman Davis last week. He came in to sit down with us. On Wednesday, I'll be speaking with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. And I'll be moderating a debate between those two candidates this Thursday at 7 o'clock. But first, we wanted to talk about two other close races that are on opposite ends of the state and opposite in many ways. One, a wealthy Chicago suburb that voted for Hillary Clinton. The other, all the way on the other side of the state in the district that borders Missouri and Kentucky and is much lower income and very much President Trump's base. In both cases, Republican Congressmen Peter Roskam and Mike Bost are trying to fend off their Democratic challengers. To tell us more, we've got two political reporters with us to talk about these races. Joe Bustos is a reporter with the Belleville News Democrat. He's on the line from their newsroom in Southern Illinois. Hey, Joe, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. How's it going?
Good. Patrick O'Connell's also with us from the Chicago Tribune in their newsroom in Chicago. Hey, Patrick. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us this morning as well.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Patrick, I wanted to start with the 6th District. That's we mentioned Republican incumbent Peter Roskam, Democrat, his opponent, Democratic challenger Sean Casten. Before we get to the men running, I wonder if you can tell us about the area they're hoping to represent as we have people listening all across the state. Where is this 6th District and who lives there?
Sure. So the 6th District is western and northwestern suburbs of Chicago. It's kind of easy to think of it as a jagged, like, video game alien that's taking a chomp out of, like, the northern part of Chicago. It is a, as you mentioned in the intro, a fairly affluent district, majority white, very packed with college-educated voters, a lot of homeowners. We're talking about suburbs, if you're familiar with some of the western suburbs, like Wheaton and Downers Grove, but then up into the areas that are also a little more rural and a little more kind of what you might describe as exurban, some former horse farm areas and that sort of thing. So we're talking about suburban voters who are very concerned about healthcare, taxes, education, and as you also mentioned, that this was a district that overwhelmingly supported Peter Roskam in the last election, but also voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
And I know the median income that we're looking at in this district is around $85,000. Joe, what about the 12th district? Can you tell us about what the median income is and also the geographic boundaries of that district?
So it's we're talking about southwestern Illinois. It's a mixture. If you go the furthest west into the St. Clair County and in the St. Louis area, it's heavy manufacturing. Then there's some bedroom communities, but a lot of this district also is rural farmland and rural areas. It's a district that voted for Congressman Mike Boss 54-39 in 2016, voted for Trump 55-40 in 2016, but also voted for Senator Duckworth 52-43. So it's one of those districts that became an early target for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, because it was a district that voted for Republican president, but a Democratic senator. It's got a lot of union membership, the strong union vote in the St. Clair County area. I think that's what some of those issues are about. People are always worried. We talking about steel tariffs here because of what they are because of some of the steel mill in Granite City. But there's also some concern from farmers as well.
Right, because the tariffs, while they may help, and they may help steel workers, they may hurt farmers. Patrick, mm-hmm. as we're talking about if we're going back up to the 6th District, back up to, as we're kind of a tale of these two districts here, you mentioned that it went for Hillary Clinton, but this is a mixed electoral history, right? It's a pretty mixed bag when it comes to how this district has voted for presidential candidates in the past.
Yeah, so the district has also voted Republican in the past, and it's also voted for Roskam, and it's voted for some Republicans in the state House and Senate, but then more recently has also returned or sent some Democrats to the state House as well. So you're right that it's changing, but it's also, I'm not sure if I would say flipping, but it's they're very discerning in terms of what they're voting on. They're not necessarily voting red or blue or D or R. They're picking their candidates based on race, race meaning like campaign, as opposed to necessarily party politics. So I think this is why, and what you mentioned nationwide, this is one of the districts across the country that both sides at the national level are focusing in on, because this is sort of a snapshot of the districts that are going to really be the linchpin for either party controlling the House.
And when we're thinking about that nuance of red and blue, Joe, I want to ask you about the 12th district, because the 12th district voted for Democratic presidential candidates from 2000 to 2012, but then in 2016 chose President Trump by a margin of 15 points. What do you think accounted for that shift?
I think part of it is there has been the population drop in the area, and just the loss of manufacturing jobs in the Midwest. So people have been trending towards Republicans over the last few years. I think that's one of the main issues. And we see in St. Clair County, which has been a traditionally Democratic stronghold, that some of that Democratic stronghold has kind of been wavering over the past years, as more of the eastern part of the county is trended Republican. And even when you go into Madison County, which has a part of the 12th district that went from a strong Democratic stronghold and to voting Republican in the 2016 election.
So let's talk about who's running against who. And I wondered if we could start with the incumbents. In particular, Joe, you have been covering Republican Mike Bost. We mentioned his name a couple of times. He holds the seat now. He's been in office since 2015. Joe, you were just talking about the steel mill in Granite City. I wanted to play some audio of Congressman Bost earlier this year on the Fox Business Channel in support of President Trump's tariffs on imported steel.
This will actually send a clear message that we want fair trade. And I don't disagree with the president on that. And many of my colleagues, they want the jobs too, okay? And
right.
We're going to work together. I think the president has done the right thing. He sent a clear message. Now, the question is where he really goes with it.
Again, that's Congressman Mike Bost, Republican incumbent on Fox Business Channel back in March. Joe, how does this issue of steel tariffs come into play? As you said, there's kind of a needle that needs to be threaded here, because this is a district that has both steel workers who have profited from this, as well as farmers who may have been hurt by the retaliatory tariffs.
Yeah, I was talking to a farmer a while back ago about these steel tariffs, and he saw his soybean prices go down. He said there's one part of the district that's celebrating, there's other part of the district that might be cussing a little bit, and I think he was trying to use friendly language, but he might have been wanting to say some other things. But you see farmers seeing a drop in their soybean and corn prices, but they're also they tend to be long-term thinkers. So it will be interesting to see if they how many of them will switch from traditionally Republican supporters to maybe voting in a Democrat for this election, not showing up at all. But you also have traditional the steel workers who have a very strong union, who've always backed Democrats. But when the president came, you had 500 steel workers in a hall standing the entire time, cheering on the president for helping bring back those steel jobs into Granite City. And they're expected to have up to 800 by the by sometime this month that have been brought back because of this.
But the big question, right? The big question, Joe, is will that support translate to Congressman Bost? The union support, I'm thinking in particular.
I mean, they endorsed Brendan Kelly. The union endorsed Brendan Kelly. But if you talk to some of the workers in just the line workers, some of them say, hey, I'm going to be supporting the guy who's done what's been good for me. So I think there might be some union workers who might go towards Mike Bost in this election.
You mentioned Brendan Kelly. I wonder if we can hear a little bit about him. I wanted to actually play a little clip from one of Brendan Kelly's campaign commercials, Joe, and ask you what you think it says about the politics of the 12th District. Let's have a listen.
As a prosecutor, I'm fighting corrupt Republicans and Democrats, taking on the drug companies who started the opioid epidemic. And I believe we need new leaders in both parties. I'm Brendan Kelly. I approve this message because it's time to restore our faith and save Southern Illinois.
Joe, I'm sure you've seen that ad, but for most of our listening area who I'm sure has not, Brendan Kelly is saying all of this as he's walking through a church. And at the part where he says we need new leadership for both parties, there's some text below that says Brendan Kelly will not back Nancy Pelosi as speaker. Why do voters in the 12th district care about whether or not a Democratic nominee would support Nancy Pelosi for speaker of the House?
One of the things that it's a very conservative district, so Nancy Pelosi is a liberal Californian, considered a very liberal Californian. Congressman Mike Bost has been saying Nancy Pelosi, she wants back in the speakership chair. Her route through the speakership runs through Southern Illinois. So Brendan Kelly has been trying to take that talking point away. I've asked him about this question several times, or a couple times. He says under no circumstances will he vote for Nancy Pelosi, but you wonder what will happen if Democrats are successful in taking back the House, and if Brendan is there, how he would handle that leadership vote, see how much pressure there is on him.
Right. Well, he's made a campaign promise at this point. Joe, yeah. There's also a Green Party candidate in this congressional race, Randy Auchsher. He's an environmental activist. He's a professor at SIU. How might he factor into this, what is now a very close race?
So there are multiple polls showing Mike Bost having a 1-point lead over Brendan Kelly, and there is a Democratic, a DCCC poll that has Randy Auchsher pulling 8% of the vote with 8% undecided. Green parties, the overwhelming assumption is usually they might vote more liberal. So there might be some consideration that he may be taking votes away from Brendan, and he might play spoiler. Now, if you ask Randy Auchsher, he says it's the Democrats' fault for nominating a conservative Democrat, quote unquote. So he might play a role, and it'll be definitely interesting to see how much he ends up, if his vote total is bigger than the margin between Mike Bost and Brendan Kelly. In the previous two elections, the Green Party candidate was Paula Bradshaw. She got 5.6% in 2014, 6% in 2016, but it was still smaller than the margin between Mike Bost and his Democratic opponent.
That's Joe Bustos. He's a reporter with the Belleville News Democrat. We've been talking about two congressional races. We've been focusing on Southern Illinois. Let's go back up to the Chicago suburbs. Patrick O'Connell is with us from the Tribune. We've been talking to him about that race. And this is a seat that's been held by Peter Roskam. He's a Republican since 2007. He's been in politics a long time, Patrick. Before that, he was a member of the Illinois General Assembly. What does his voting record say about where he stands ideologically? You were talking earlier about this district and how nuanced it is in terms of how the vote goes sometimes.
So Roskam was one of the lead architects of the House tax overhaul bill, which he says is going to help voters in the district by returning more money into their pockets by all of the tax changes that are going to eventually help you or have already started, he would argue, putting more money in your paycheck. He's trying to thread the needle on tax issues, like I just mentioned, but also some of the social issues, but also on President Trump. You guys were talking about Nancy Pelosi as a national figure and how that might play into voters' minds locally or regionally. And so he has basically tried to distance himself from President Trump, something that his opponent, Democrat Sean Casson, has tried to tie in to him by saying that he votes with the president 94% of the time, is something that you hear over and over from Sean Casson.
Is that accurate?
And so, so it is, but Roskam would it is, and Roskam would argue that when he needs to, he separates from the president on local issues when it comes to, like I mentioned, the tax policy, or he says he supports Great Lakes Bill Great Lakes funding. That's something that he repeatedly mentioned. So it's going to be interesting to see how he's able to navigate those issues over the last couple of weeks in the campaign.
We have to take a break in a minute here, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Patrick, I want to ask you a little bit about Sean Casson. And as we're looking at these races, they are really close. This past weekend, Cook Political Report, we often talk about that a lot. That's a nonpartisan organization out of Washington that evaluates all kinds of races. This past weekend, they moved the 6th district race to lean Democratic. That's the race we're going to talk about after the break and find out a little bit more about Sean Casson with the 12th. They say is still a toss-up. So stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. When we come back, we're going to finish this conversation with Patrick O'Connell from the Chicago Tribune and Joe Bustos from the Belleville News Democrat.
Comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting a talk by Professor James Anderson, Citizenship, Immigration, and National Identity, Civic Education on the Sesquicentennial Anniversary of the 14th Amendment, Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. More at cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Mondays, we like to talk about Illinois politics, focus a little on our state. Today, we've been talking about the Illinois' congressional districts and congressional races as the midterms approach. By the way, for the 13th congressional district, lots of people who are listening are in that area. That's where Congressman Rodney Davis is facing off against Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. As I mentioned earlier, Thursday, I'll be moderating a debate between those two candidates. We're still looking for questions for you. If you have questions you would like to pose to these two candidates, please leave us a voicemail. Our phone number for that is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. And tune in on Thursday at 7 o'clock for that debate. We've been focusing, though, right now on two other congressional races from the Chicago suburbs all the way down to southern Illinois to a district that borders both Missouri and Kentucky. And we've been talking about that with Patrick O'Connell from the Chicago Tribune and Joseph Bustos from the Belleville News Democrat. Patrick, getting back to your district outside of Chicago that we've been talking about, as we mentioned, Peter Roskam has been around for some time. He's a longtime incumbent. What can you tell us about Sean Casson? He's a former CEO of a Chicago-based clean energy company.
Correct. He ran two clean energy companies for more than a decade, and essentially what they were doing is they were trying to convert waste gas from primarily coal plants and turn around and turn that into reuse that emissions and turn that into power. He did that, like I said, for more than a decade, and he's a first-time candidate. This is the first time he's running for political office. He won his primary, obviously, in March, and he's been running a very strong campaign, as you mentioned prior to the intro. The race is either leaning towards him or a toss-up, depending on which poll you pay attention to. And he's gotten enormous support, both locally and nationally. He's got $2.6 million, his campaign reports. We'll find out a little bit more about that as the financial reports come in today from in the third quarter alone, which outdistanced Roskam by quite a bit. So he has been hammering Roskam, saying he's out of touch with this district. He's supporting universal affordable health care. With his in energy environment background, he's been very adept at talking about environmental issues and about the environment and how Roskam hasn't done enough in that regard. So it's been very interesting to see him run such a strong campaign against Roskam, who won last time despite Hillary Clinton winning by 18 points.
And as we think about this, I wonder what the biggest questions you have are in these last few weeks before Election Day. Patrick, let's start with you.
So I think it's a good question. I think what it's going to come down to is the balance between what's going on nationally and what's going on regionally, whether people are simply going to go to the ballot box and vote for a Democrat or Republican as a referendum on President Trump, or as a maybe not so much Trump, but because they want one party to either remain in control or to, as you've been mentioning, the blue wave and the flip the sixth is the sort of the hashtag for the Kasten campaign, and whether that's more important to them than some of the individual issues, and maybe how those individual issues fit into how both the swing voters in the middle, who may have voted for Roskam in the past but are just fed up with either the Republicans or Trump, and are going to vote for a Democrat either for the first time or that they're oscillating back and forth in the past, or whether it's going to be a turnout issue in terms of the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, whether that's going to be motivating Democrats or those more on the right or progressives to come out in kind of that way that we're talking about, overwhelming Republicans who may not come out in a non-presidential election year.
And this is a district that also voted for President Obama, that also elected President Obama twice, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, so really interesting in terms of those, all of those issues you mentioned. Joe, what are you thinking about in terms of Southern Illinois and the 12th District?
I wonder if Brendan Kelly is going to be successful in reawakening, I guess, maybe the old Jerry Costello Democrats that are down here, see if he could get that St. Clair County quote-unquote machine going for him, and if he's going to be able to at least break even down the southern part of the district. He was advertising early in the southern part of this district in those areas that border Kentucky and Missouri. So I think those are going to be that's going to be interesting. But you also wonder if Congressman Bost is in a district that voted for President Trump, if people are happy with President Trump down here, if Congressman Bost is going to be able to get his party energized down here.
Right. And then when we think about, as you mentioned, how conservative the district is, and we've heard about with the Kavanaugh hearings, the possibility of that electrifying both sides, that's also an open question, you think, Joe?
It might be, but it's one of those things that I don't know how much the national issues play down here. I think whether that news cycle has passed since Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed,
right?
You don't hear too much about from the Brendan Kelly campaign. Oddly enough, they even though they talk up his efforts in combating sexual assault as prosecutor over here, they have been trying to focus a lot on local issues.
This is Joe Bustos with the Belleville News Democrat. I want to thank Patrick O'Connell as well with the Chicago Tribune. Guys, thanks for filling us in on these races. Be interesting to see what happens.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before Amazon, Costco, even Walmart, there was Sears. The Illinois-based company has been around since 1893 and was once the largest retailer in the world. And while Sears isn't totally gone yet, the company has been a shadow of its former self for a long time, and this morning marked another chapter in Sears' decline. The company officially filed for bankruptcy. CEO Eddie Lampert will step down. How did Sears get to this point, and what's next for the 68,000 people who still work for the retailer? James O'Rourke is with us. He's a professor of management at Notre Dame University's Mendoza College of Business. James, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
And by the way, if you're listening and if you have memories of either shopping or working at Sears, you can always give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. James, I know we can't tell the whole story of Sears, but I do hope you can remind us a little of what it used to be, especially the fact people might forget that Sears actually used to be the world's largest retailer. How did that first happen?
Well, if you go back to the beginning of the last century, Sears dominated the world of retailing with its catalog. It was easy to buy virtually anything you wanted. You could get the level of quality, you could get the fit and style that you wanted, and it would be delivered right to your doorstep. This was a time when two-thirds of Americans lived in rural areas or on farms. The nation urbanized after that. A number of things happened, but really just 5 years ago, Sears had 250,000 employees. They have just 89,000 now. In their heyday, they had 3,000 stores in addition to the catalog. There are, including Kmart now, 700 stores in that company, Sears Holding, and they're about to close 142 of them. They're looking closely at another 250. There was a time when Sears used to say, everybody in this country either worked at Sears or knows someone who worked at Sears. That's how powerful and big the company was in those days. Today, there really are three reasons Sears has failed. First, and I think foremost, no value proposition. You can only compete on four things: service, selection, quality, and price. And Sears right now isn't competing on any of them. It's easy to look at the retailing market and say it's tough, but Walmart at the bottom end is competing on price and doing well. Some bumpy quarters, but they're doing well. At the top end, people like Nordstrom, Bloomingdale's, Saks Fifth Avenue are competing on quality and service, and they're doing very well.
No, so it's not just a question of, I think a lot of people tend to think about, oh, this is another death of brick and mortar retail. We're speaking to James O'Rourke, who teaches at the University of Notre Dame, and about Sears bankruptcy filing this morning. We've also got Bridget Sweeney on the line with us. She's a consumer reporter from Crain's Chicago Business. Hey, Bridget, thanks for joining us as well.
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me.
Bridget, I wonder if we could, as we're thinking about this, just as James is talking about the whole idea, is it's not just the death of a brick and mortar retail. What specifically do you think missteps Sears has made to lead it to this point?
Well, absolutely. As James kind of referenced, you know, it's not just, everyone says retailing is so impossibly difficult these days. And there are examples both on the lower end of the spectrum and the upper end that disprove that. They're adapting, they're doing just fine these days. Sears specifically, it can trace its troubles way back to before Eddie Lampert, you know, the hedge fund, quote-unquote, genius of last decade, you know, merged Sears and Kmart in 2005. Its problems really preceded it back to the 1990s when the rise of big box stores came up. Sears, you know, as we had earlier discussed, you know, kind of made its name as a mall anchor back in the day when, you know, autos were becoming popular, when suburban sprawl was occurring. A Sears popped up in every single one of these new malls, and that was perfect. In the 1990s, people started going, quote-unquote, off-mall to strip malls to
So this is like the Target, like the Target, the Walmart, exactly, kind of thing.
Okay. Exactly, Target, the Walmart. Sears back then tried to do the same thing. It's typical, like a strategy move when you're becoming, you know, someone's encroaching on you, you try and fight back by doing the same thing. So they opened these stores called Sears Essentials, Sears Grand. They were off-mall stores that tried to offer the same kind of offerings as Target and Walmart. What really should have happened then is that they should have been looking ahead to, you know, to the online revolution. Even in, you know, the mid to late 90s, obviously, you know, online shopping was an early, you know, people were making moves. Obviously, Jeff Bezos founded Amazon in 1994. You know, had they been able to look ahead instead of just trying to kind of myopically match what their immediate competitors were doing, they could have kind of, you know, hopscotched those competitors and moved on to the next big thing. But that would have required quite a bit of foresight that clearly previous management didn't have. And then when Mr. Lampert took over, he was so kind of crazily focused on extracting value and on not putting money into stores that weren't making money that he kind of hastened, you know, what's known as the typical death spiral, where when you don't put money into stores and you don't keep your inventory fresh and appealing, then you give people who are already starting to move away from your stores fewer and fewer reasons to actually show up. And we watched that happen. Anyone who's looked at the quarterly reports for Sears from the last
or walked into a Sears store, Bridget, because I mean, I think you can even see it if you go into a store. We're talking about a Sears Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing this morning with Bridget Sweeney from Crane Chicago Business and James O'Rourke, who teaches in the College of Business at Notre Dame. And you, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. As we're talking about Illinois, one of Illinois' best known brands, best known companies. We'd love to hear your memories of either shopping or working at Sears. Let's go to Joel from Bloomington. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the 21st. Did you used to work at Sears in the 1990s?
Yes, I used to work in New Orleans in Sears in the 1990s.
What'd you like about it?
I was in the electronics department, and I enjoyed just interacting with people and getting them the products they wanted. I even got friends from college, fellow students. I even got them jobs because since I was there, I recommended them and they came and worked there.
So this was a college job for you?
Yeah.
All right. Definitely. Thanks for sharing that, Joel. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Hey, Joel, are you still there? Or did I lose you?
Yeah. No,
what did you think when you saw the news about the bankruptcy filing this morning?
It's kind of inevitable in the fact that I do a lot of shopping online. So I haven't been in Sears. There's one in town in Bloomington and I don't go there that often. So I think, you know, people just trend online instead of going to the brick and mortar.
Yeah, thanks for that, Joel. That's Joel from Bloomington. Give us a call if you want to share your memories of working or shopping at Sears, 1-800-222-9455. James, to that point that Joel just made about online, I just wonder what direction the company goes in now, if there's a bankruptcy filing. Bridget, I want to get to you in a minute about the logistics of that and what that means. But where does Sears stand now, you think, James?
Well, I'm sure, as Bridget will tell you, a Chapter 11 filing is not liquidation. That's Chapter 7. The courts would appoint a trustee and they would dissolve the assets and pay the creditors. With Chapter 11, there's a chance to reorganize. This is, in my view, and this is kind of considered opinion here, that's a ruse. It's a cover story. There is no future for Sears. What Chapter 11 will permit, which Chapter 7 wouldn't, is debtor in possession financing. And it will mean that the $300 million that they've gotten will pay off the $134 million of debt, and another $166 million be used to operate the stores, about 450 remaining stores, through Christmas. There'll be all kinds of ads. People will think they're getting a bargain. It's really last year's merchandise. There are no new merchandise deliveries at Sears. Three vendors reported this week to Reuters that they had not received payments from Sears. And of course, back in May, Whirlpool said, "We're done. No more washers and dryers." And
oh dear. So it's really not been a good situation for some time, it sounds like.
No.
Okay. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. Bridget, I want to just ask you about Sears employees, what this Chapter 11 filing means for current employees as well as retirees. Stay tuned to the 21st as we're talking about Sears filing for Chapter 11 this morning, the latest chapter in Sears' decline. You're listening to the 21st. Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about the Chapter 11 filing for bankruptcy by Sears this morning. We've been talking about, in Bridget Sweeney's word, the death spiral, maybe, that's our once the world's largest retailer, Illinois-based Sears, is in. Bridget Sweeney is with Crane Chicago Business. She's on the line from there. We've got James O'Rourke with us as well. He teaches management at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Bridget, to the point of employees, James was just talking about it's a Chapter 11 filing. It's not a liquidation. What happens to the employees who are left right now?
So, I mean, that's kind of a twofold question between both the pension obligation and just literally the employees who continue to work in the store.
Right.
As James had mentioned, you know, the company is immediately going to close more than 140 of the remaining stores. So obviously those store employees will lose their jobs, as we've known, because Sears has closed more than 1,000 stores over the past about 7 years. Every time, you know, they close stores, they do send out statements saying, you know, they do try and reassign employees to other stores and provide some sort of severance.
These are Sears and Kmart stores, right? Just to be clear.
Mm-hmm. Both stores. Yeah, to be clear. Perfect. Yep. So, you know, I'm not clear the amount of severance they get. Obviously, as the number of stores has winnowed so dramatically, they can't conceivably reassign people to nearby stores. There's just too many people. So people are definitely out of jobs. Up in Hoffman Estates, you know, where Sears has its corporate headquarters, they have been laying people off there too as well. Most recently, a couple hundred people this past summer, I believe. That number is also dwindling. And it remains to be seen how many more people will be axed as a result of this move.
And what about retirees?
So that's been a huge point of contention. Sears has long underfunded its pension responsibilities. They pay, I mean, just this earlier this year, they put more than $400 million into a payment, but they're still behind. There's a government entity called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that essentially is a lifeline. You know, they kind of take over. In bankruptcy protection, companies generally don't fund their pension obligations any longer. But in that case, the government, the PBGC, takes over. So people who are receiving pensions, as I understand it, will continue to receive their pensions.
And James, in fact, for other corporations, that's been one of the reasons why they filed for Chapter 11 to renegotiate or avoid pension obligations, right?
Yes. Let me just go ahead and call that a clever financial but unethical move. A company that decides to shed health care, pension, and benefit obligations. Sears closed down death benefits for retirees earlier this year. You know, it puts the burden of mismanagement squarely on the backs of the people who helped to create the wealth and prosperity that shareholders and other executives benefited from. And it's really sad to think about that. But there isn't enough left there. They'll get through February or so, and I think you will see liquidation at that point, because the three big banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citibank, are the principal lenders on that asset-backed credit line. That's secured by store inventory, some credit card debts, some pharmacy receivables. Once those are gone, they want out. They'll get their money. I think, curiously, Mr. Lampert, through ESL, his hedge fund, has taken possession of some pretty valuable assets, including the Oak Brook Sears store. It's the largest footprint in the Oak Brook Mall. He also owns two-thirds of the parking lot out there. Mm. He's got some useful properties that I'm certain he will sell. The rest of all of that will simply go dark, and the mall operators will be left to figure out what to do.
It's interesting to see what happens with that. We're almost out of time here, but I want to go to one last caller. Abby's on the line from Belvedere, just outside of Rockford. Hi, Abby. Welcome to the 21st. What memory did you want to share with us?
I just have kind of ending on like a good memory is that my grandparents would always send us or have the Sears catalog mailed to us, and we always looked forward to it every single year. We'd each get our markers and lay down and write our names on our catalog so that they weren't mistaken of who they are. And we would basically make out our Christmas list, our wish list of outfits and toys and different things that we wanted, because the Sears catalog is what we looked forward to every year to do that.
Mm, yeah, sad. Was it sad for you to see the news this morning, Abby?
Not really, to be honest with you. Unfortunately, with the way that everything has kind of shifted to online, we now, our kids, and actually with Toys R Us too, like they usually would look through the paper and find ads and circle, and now they're basically using the internet.
Right, they're doing Amazon wish lists, right, Abby?
Yeah, they're doing Amazon wish lists or Target wish list or something like that. So,
right. Well, thanks for that.
Those memories with them.
Yeah, so. Thanks for sharing that, Abby. And I think that's a good note to end on. I want to thank Bridget Sweeney with Crane Chicago Business, James O'Rourke with Notre Dame. Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Nyla. It was great.
As Illinois celebrates its 200th birthday this year, throughout the year we've been celebrating alongside the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum with their Illinois 200 lists, which are recognizing important moments, people, and places in our state's bicentennial history that you're voting on. So far we've heard about the books, films, artists, and more that have helped define our state. And today we're going to talk about some of our greatest scientists, not just well-known names like James Watson, who discovered the structure of DNA, but African-American chemist Percy LeVon Julian and Peoria's Allene Jeans. We're going to find out more about these people with Chris Wills, the communications director at the library, and Valerie Higgins, who's a lab archivist and historian for Fermi National Laboratories in Batavia. Chris, Valerie, good morning. Thanks for being with me.
Glad to be here.
Good morning.
Valerie, I think we should start with the one name that people are also, apart from James Watson, would be very familiar with in Illinois, and that's Enrico Fermi, the namesake for the lab you work at. He came in number one at the list. I think people hear about Fermi Labs, but people may not know very much about Enrico Fermi. What can you tell us about him?
So Enrico Fermi was born in Italy in 1901, and he won the 1938 Nobel Prize in Physics. And he actually used the prize ceremony as an opportunity to go to Stockholm to claim his prize in 1938. But then instead of returning to Italy, he came to the United States to flee the fascist dictatorship that was running Italy at the time. And shortly after he arrived in the United States, he joined the University of Chicago here in Illinois, their metallurgical laboratory, where he led the group that created the world's first controlled self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction on December 2nd of 1942. And that chain reaction laid the groundwork for the Manhattan Project.
Mm. And then there's also, in terms of Fermi, there's also another name on the list. Is it Leon? Is it Letterman?
Yes.
He was a longtime director for Fermi Labs, right?
He was. And so Leon Lederman was the lab's second director. And he became director in 1978, though before that he'd played a key role in the lab with things like in 1977 he led the experiment that discovered the bottom quark. And he was the lab's director during the time that the Tevatron, which was for many years the world's most powerful particle accelerator, during the years that it was being built. And it was really his leadership that made the Tevatron possible. And he was the lab's director until 1989.
So as we're talking about this, Chris Wills is also on the line with us from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. They helped compile this list. Chris, when we think about Illinois and our scientific contribution, the scientists who've come from here, I even wonder when we think about Nobel winners, a lot of these winner people on the list have won the Nobel Prize. How many Nobel winners have come out of Illinois in science? Do we know?
We don't have an exact number because some winners may have grown up in Illinois but then gone on to do their groundbreaking work somewhere else and don't really show up on our lists. But I've found 83 who attended University of Illinois, University of Chicago, Northwestern, or were teaching there when they won the Nobel.
Well, that's pretty good. I wanted to, speaking of U of I, there's a name that people might remember in the U of I community. That's John Bardeen. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics twice, Chris?
Yes, he's the only person to win the Nobel in Physics two times. He helped invent the transistor, which just, you know, revolutionized electronics in the middle of the 20th century. And then he did research into superconductivity, and that's way above my level of understanding, but I believe it had a real significant contribution to MRIs and other sort of scanning possibilities now.
And then Percy Julian is also not just an important figure in science, but also in civil rights, right, Chris?
Yeah, Percy Julian was an African-American entrepreneur and scientist who set up his own lab and really was a pioneer in making substances like progesterone and testosterone available, you know, making it in large quantities for medicines. He was African-American and was the first African-American chemist in the National Academy of Sciences. So he was an important figure in what he discovered and also in, you know, opening the doors for others.
Valerie, there are two women listed in the top 10, Aline Jeans and Francine Patterson. Can you tell us a little bit about them before I ask if there are any other female scientists you would like to have had on the list?
Well, I don't really have a background with those two scientists, but the one that I thought would be an interesting addition to the list was Helen Edwards, who was a longtime accelerator physicist at Fermilab. She led the accelerator division, and she oversaw the design, construction, operation of the Tevatron, which was the world's first superconducting particle accelerator and the world's most powerful accelerator from 1983 to 2010. And that work earned her a MacArthur Fellowship Genius Grant in 1988 and then also the National Medal of Technology in 1989. So I think she's definitely a scientist who is a woman and did much of her work here in Illinois who would be worthy of being on that list.
Thanks for that, Valerie. We're speaking with Valerie Higgins, who's a lab archivist and historian for Fermi. Aline Jeans, by the way, was in Peoria, discovered a way to produce dextran, which could temporarily replace lost blood in our team. Also discovered xanthan gum, which we know is in a lot of things. Francine Patterson, an animal psychologist known for teaching sign language to a gorilla named Coco. Chris, as you've been compiling these lists, why was it important to talk about scientists as we think about our state's bicentennial?
Well, we're trying to celebrate so many different facets of Illinois, art, politics, sports, and culture, and I just don't think you can overlook Illinois' contributions to science. These people on this list, whether they did their work here or grew up here and then worked elsewhere, contributed so much to modern America and to the world, really. So it would be a shame to overlook these folks when they should be recognized.
Chris, what's next in the series of top 10 lists? Is there voting going on right now?
Yeah, we just finished up voting on the groundbreaking women category, and those results just came out. And now at IllinoisTop200.com, people can vote on minority trailblazers, people who broke racial barriers or were the first in their field. It's a fascinating category.
Okay. Valerie, before I let you go, any other names we should think about when we think about Illinois science that we haven't talked about?
Well, one other that came to mind for me was Robert Wilson, who was the first director of Fermilab. He was a prominent physicist, and he's also been nicknamed the father of proton therapy for a paper he published in 1946 called Radiological Use of Fast Protons. And he also did a lot to really shape what Fermilab is today. And he won the National Medal of Science in 1973 for his work at Fermilab.
Lots of scientists in our state's history as we think about that as another celebration of Illinois' bicentennial year. I want to thank Valerie Higgins, who's a lab archivist and historian for Fermi Labs, Chris Wills for being with us again as he's been guiding us through these lists that the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum have been putting out. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That does it for us today. By the way, our website, 21stshow.org, has got lots of election information. If you are voting early or you're preparing to vote, go to 21stshow.org, and right at the top, we'll have all of our election information. And again, we've got a congressional debate that I'll be moderating on Thursday night. If you have questions you want to ask Congressman Rodney Davis or his opponent, his challenger, Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, give us a call. Leave us a voicemail. It's 217-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. Again, 217-300-2121. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.